The Evolve with Pete Evans podcast is a conversation about my favourite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. I love exploring the topics that are not traditionally taught at school and take a deep dive into them with my special guests. I invite you to sit back and come along for the ride with an open mind and heart, and please share with your family and friends, as these podcasts may just be the seed from which many things will flourish from. Cheers. We've been using Waters Co. water filters for the last 10 years, and I wholeheartedly trust my family's health with them. Waters Co., established 1977, have personal and domestic water filters, which turns your ordinary tap water into great-tasting, alkaline, ionized mineral water, which removes up to 99.9% of fluoride, heavy metals, chemicals, and bacteria, so you can love your tap water again. The Bio 1000 is the latest edition of the BMP 1000 model and the culmination of over 40 years of experience and research into water filtration by some of the world's leading scientists. Waters Co. was first to market with natural gravity-fed systems, creating alkaline water way back in 1984, and have continued to lead the market in research and development, setting the benchmark for all other brands to follow. Please go to my webpage, PeteEvans.com, to learn more and to receive your special discount from my link on the products page. You're going to love it. Today we feature Nina Tescholtz. Before taking a deep dive into researching nutritional science for nearly a decade, Nina was a reporter for National Public Radio and also contributed to many publications, including The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, Washington Post, The New Yorker, and The Economist. She attended Yale and Stanford, where she studied biology and majored in American Studies. She has a major's degree from Oxford University and served as Associate Director of the Center for Globalization and Sustainable Development at Columbia University. To find out more about Nina, visit her Facebook at Nina Tescholtz, or check out her website, ninatescholtz.com, and check out her amazing book, The Big Fat Surprise. Nina, thank you so much for being a part of our podcast. And your book, The Big Fat Surprise, has been revolutionary in so many ways. It actually talks about the word that most people are afraid of, and that is F-A-T. So tell me about how you came to write about this really dirty word, and tell us about where we are at in human history and how we should be actually be embracing the right type of fats, and that we shouldn't be scared of these, and it should become a very good word for us to include into our vocabulary and into our diets.
Well, thank you. I'm delighted to be on your podcast. And you know, it's funny that you spell that out as if the taboo that cannot be mentioned, the word F-A-T. It's interesting, the moment that we're in. I do think that we're in a moment where actually fat is not considered as bad as it was in the, you know, the height of the non-fat 1980s is when everybody was, you know, wouldn't touch even salmon or nuts. I mean, some of us can remember those days when even those foods were considered sort of off limits, and you would have your salad dry without any salad dressing, not even olive oil. So that's the height of the non-fat 1980s. But, you know, we've really come quite a ways from there. And so now we're in this moment where there is a kind of revival of a diet that is higher in fat. I mean, even our officials, like in our country, the American Heart Association or our dietary guidelines are talking about, you know, you can add fat back into your diet so long as it's salmon, you know, fish, nuts, olive oil, olives. Those are the things that are kind of the safe zone fats. And I guess what I did in my book, which was so controversial, and I really didn't mean to write a book about this at all. I started writing a book about trans fats, actually, that came out of an article that I had written in a magazine. I got a contract to write a book about trans fats, which, you know, now most people know about. And then I realized there was just this huge story about how he had gotten it all wrong on really all dietary fats. So what I wrote about, the central thesis of my book, is that really that it not only is fat okay, but an even more taboo word, saturated fat, is okay for health. And those are the kind of fats that you find in, you know, meat and dairy. The reason that we don't eat meat and dairy or coconut oil is a plant-based one, or, you know, the reason we don't eat those foods or we haven't eaten them for decades is because of their saturated fat content. And my book, really, the main argument of my book is that we got it wrong on saturated fats, which is really out there in terms of, you know, if we think like we're kind of in this paradigm shift in nutrition. So the idea that saturated fats could be okay is really kind of on the front lines of that paradigm shift.
So let's talk about how you became, I guess, an expert, and this became part of your purpose or life plan to actually expose this and spread the truth, because the people that I speak to on this podcast have one thing in common. They like speaking the truth, and they all have their life purpose. They want to help people, and they want to help people by giving them the facts. So let's take a step back. As how did Nina get into this role?
I think my story is like many people's in this field, where we didn't start off with this desire to become an advocate or fight for the truth in some area. I mean, I'm a journalist, to be specific. I was a vegetarian of 25 years, sort of not a very serious journalist, but interested in science. And then it was like this subject just took hold of me. I started researching it. It took me almost 10 years to write my book. I read thousands upon thousands of nutrition science papers, all the original papers going back to the 1950s. It was like this detective story trying to track down, where do we get our ideas that fat and saturated fat are bad for you? How do we come to that? Who are the people and the players and the industry? And how did this all happen? And it was just this incredible, fascinating story that I just could not stop reading and investigating. And I also really knew that because what I was discovering was so controversial, that everything I said had to be ironclad, and that I didn't just have to read some papers, I had to read every paper. You know, if I wrote a sentence, I had to be absolutely sure that it was 100% true and I had read everything on that subject. So yeah, I became obsessed. It was like a complete obsession. And then, so then out came this book. And again, you know, terrifying to come out with a book that challenges all the status quo advice by every major public health association, by the government, by every expert. You know, I can't tell you how many nights I would just like lie down on the floor in front of my husband and say, I can't possibly do this. I can't possibly be right. I must be wrong. And, you know, and then just going over and double checking and triple checking everything. But eventually, the book was published in 2014. I'd been kind of interviewing, been on in most major publications now, been debating scientists, been talking to people, and I really pressure tested all these arguments, and I really, you know, feel more confident now than ever before that the arguments hold up. I haven't found yet an argument that undermines what I'm saying. And actually, to my great delight, the Lancet, which is one of the top medical journals in the world, came out just in August of this year saying, actually, a full page review of my book saying, you know, Nina Teicholz was, this book is going to make you angry, but she's right. Which is an incredible endorsement. But I think, like other people in the field, what happens is you see how this harmful, wrong, weak dietary advice that's never been based on good science has harmed so many people. You know, for me, it was an extra 20 pounds that I carried around most of my young adult life. And so, okay, I didn't have a lot of boyfriends. I wasn't considered very, you know, very attractive. That only ruined a little part of my life. But, you know, how many stories have I heard now? Are people writing me about losing their limbs to diabetes, losing their loved ones to heart disease, to diabetes, to, you know, the pain of severe living with severe obesity, and knowing that these are all people who have faithfully followed their doctor's orders and tried so hard, but they've been given the wrong advice. And so eventually there boils up in you this just tremendous anger that there's so many lives lost, so much money wasted, so much bad advice. And so, you know, in this case, I think people become fanatic, like I have become more fanatic about this issue, because, you know, truth is like a kind of justice. People need to know the truth because their lives are being taken away from them by being told lies. A diabetic goes to their doctor and the doctor says, you must eat a high carbohydrate diet. And that will only make their condition worse and hasten their death. I mean, that is a terrible thing that our experts, many of them don't know that they're giving the wrong advice, but there are some public institutions that do know. So I think that's what instills such a passion in so many people working on this issue.
Well, let's tap into that a little bit more, because you say so many doctors don't actually know the right advice. So where is this heading into the future? I mean, you're at the forefront of this, and can you tell me about how this is going to change in a large way for the population, whether it be in the United States, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, the Western population, or globally? What's happening at the moment?
So that is an excellent question, because where does the wrong advice come from? I think most doctors give their advice in good faith. They get very little training in nutrition anyway, and then what they're told is wrong. After spending some time really investigating this, I realized that the center of all bad advice, the Death Star from which all bad advice flows, really is the dietary guidelines of our various nations. Mm-hmm. And actually, the one that matters the most, I hate to say this, is the U.S. dietary guidelines, because we were the first country to have them starting in 1980, and we basically exported our guidelines to the rest of the world. And our guidelines were based on weak science. Much of it had been contradicted already by the time they and disproven. But anyway, our guidelines basically proposed a low-fat, high-carbohydrate diet, high in grains, over, you know, between 50 and 60% of all your calories is grains. I just want to, or carbohydrates, just to give you a comparison, most nations were eating under 40% of their diet as carbohydrates before these guidelines were introduced. Mm. And the reason the guidelines are so important, I mean, most people say, you must be kidding. Who goes to a government website to learn about their nutrition? Right? Nobody does that. However, it's those guidelines are considered the gold standard. So, and they are downloaded to medical associations, nutritionist association, the dietitians association, and that then flows down to every healthcare practitioner on the front lines, every nutritionist, dietitian, medical doctor. They are just downloading the guidelines. So that's where your advice comes from when you go to your trusted healthcare practitioner. And in many cases, doctors are prohibited from giving any advice other than the guidelines because there's a fear of legal malpractice, that maybe the doctor will be sued if something happens if they don't follow the quote-unquote gold standard. In many countries, the food assistance programs, like food programs for the poor or school lunches or feeding programs for the elderly, hospitals, all military rations in hospitals, everything is based on the guidelines. In fact, there's many cases of people who have kind of healed themselves through good nutrition, and then they go to the hospital for whatever reason, and they get dramatically worse because the hospital food is so bad. I mean, I don't know, you know, in the U.S., you get like 60-70% carbs for your hospital meals.
I think it could be higher in Australia.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you get like a cherry Danish for breakfast, just, you know, and then you're told, make sure you eat so you can recover your good health. The guidelines are hugely important. They also determine what food companies follow the guidelines, because they want to be able to put those healthy claims on their packages. And it's so important. So when I came to realize how powerful the guidelines were, I realized they just need to change. I'll just give you one more example of how powerful the guidelines are. You know, in your country, Gary Fetke, an orthopedic surgeon, he's been told that he cannot practice nutrition because he's giving low carb advice and that doesn't follow the guidelines. And many people know the case of Tim Noakes in South Africa. He was practically had his medical license taken away from him because he was not following the guidelines. And there are similar cases in Ireland, now in Canada. And so if you aren't following the quote unquote gold standard, you can be persecuted or your life can be very difficult as a practitioner. So this is why the guidelines themselves really are the most important lever for change, I think. And so, you know, our approach in the US, when we've started a group called the Nutrition Coalition, which is just a not-for-profit, we accept no industry money. We're purely in the interest of public health. And our group is made up of doctors and PhDs and journalists. And we have, our members are just average people who have recovered their health by ignoring the guidelines. And our goal is to bring our point of view to Washington and to say, we need evidence-based guidelines. We're actually not even saying we know what the best diet is. We're just saying we want our guidelines based on rigorous evidence. I know because I've analyzed the entire evidence. Another obsessive thing I did. I looked at every single piece of science that our guidelines are based on. I looked at all their references. I looked them all up and I put them all on a spreadsheet. And I discovered that they were relying almost exclusively on this weak kind of science called epidemiology, which can only show association but not causation. And that they were ignoring almost all of the more rigorous evidence called randomized controlled clinical trials that actually show cause and effect. They were ignoring billions of dollars in clinical trials that had actually been funded by our National Institutes of Health. And they had just like either ignored them or suppressed them or forgotten about them. I really don't know, but those trials are not anywhere in the evidence base. So that work became a cover story in the British Medical Journal that was then the subject of an enormous retraction effort by scientists all over the world. But that paper stood, and what it established is that our guidelines are not based on rigorous evidence, which is the most crucial thing that we are fighting for. We want our guidelines to be based on good, sound science, which means randomized controlled clinical trials on human beings, which we have. That evidence base exists. It's just being ignored.
In Australia, for instance, what we have, whenever I guess myself or people that promote this way of life mention this, whether it be in social media or into the media itself, what usually comes back is the spokesperson or even the CEO of our Dietary Association of Australia comes out and says, well, low-carb healthy fat hasn't been studied, and we have 50,000 papers to back up our current dietary guidelines. And what you're talking about, Pete Evans or Gary Fetke, is potentially dangerous for the population. And the journalists love to just quote the dietitians and say, we have 50,000 papers. So what you're saying is that is based on false science?
So the critical thing to understand here is the difference between weak science, which is epidemiology. Again, that's a science of associations. Okay, so just to give you an example of how wrong epidemiology can go. Let's say you find an association between yellow fingers and death from lung cancer. And you say, oh my goodness, yellow fingers cause, you know, lung cancer. But what actually causes lung cancer is smoking. And smoking is what gives you yellow fingers. But meanwhile, you had a whole health campaign to scrub off people's yellow fingers, thinking that's the problem. That's just like one of the examples of the way epidemiology can go wildly 100% wrong. I mean, another one is like, there's a really good association between internet use and lung cancer. What is that about? Does internet really cause lung cancer? No, maybe not. Maybe, you know, maybe people who use the internet are more likely to, you know, engage in some other unhealthy behavior or something. I mean, you never know what's going on with an association. Or to use a really relevant example, they have found associations between eating red meat and higher rates of various diseases. Well, who has been eating red meat for the last 30 years? I mean, it's anybody who listens to their doctor and tries to be health conscious avoids red meat, right? Except for like the paleo people. I mean, people who are eating red meat are also likely to be doing a whole lot of other things. If they're ignoring their doctor about red meat, they're ignoring their doctor about taking pills, they're ignoring their doctor about, you know, exercising. And in fact, red meat eaters are found to generally exercise less, be more, you know, overweight, go to fewer cultural events, be, you know, they're not the kind of people who are following health advice. So this is the problem with epidemiology. And epidemiology, when it's actually tested, that means it's actually put to a clinical trial, it's found that to be correct 0 to 20% of the time. That means it can be confirmed when you actually test it in a clinical trial a maximum of 20% of the time. So that means it's wrong 80 to 100% of the time. Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, those are just zero. Those are just terrible odds on which to base the public health, right? So those 50,000 papers they're talking to, and again, I know because I reviewed every single paper they looked at for the dietary guidelines in the United States. Those are like 90% of those, at least, are epidemiological papers, which may be right, but are 80 to 100% likely to be wrong. And meanwhile, when they say there's no evidence for the low-carb diet, you can just go to that BMJ paper I told you about that I wrote, where I cite and I have a downloadable file of the more than 70 randomized controlled clinical trials that have been done on the low-carb diet as of 2015 when that paper was published. There are surely more now. And those include three clinical trials that lasted 2 years long. 2 years is considered long enough to turn up any harmful side effects. That's just the standard in the field. So there are three two-year-long trials that show no harmful side effects from low carb. And if you look at those low carb studies, they always show a better result than low fat studies significantly. As far as I know, there are no comparisons of low fat where low fat looks significantly more effective than low carb.
My family and I have been using beautiful, high-quality essential oils for the last 20 years to live healthily every single day. Now, if you're passionate about health and are ready to step into leadership, I want to invite you to partner with my team and I to build a beautifully successful doTERRA business. Register at petehlc.com/Pete. That's PeteHLC, which stands for the Healthy Living Collective, .com/Pete.
So, Nina, if anyone's listening to this that is studying to be a dietitian or a nutritionist or a doctor, and they're going to university for 4 or 5 years, and the information that they're being taught is based on, quite a lot of it is possibly based on weak science or poor science and actually isn't the truth, how is this going to change? I mean, you have your group that is petitioning Washington to change the dietary guidelines. But are you optimistic, pessimistic? I mean, you're up against some big forces here. And how long do you think the change is going to take?
You know, Pete, I think you and I both have had reason to feel pessimistic in the past, you know, about the possibilities of change. I mean, we both, I think, faced criticism and seen the magnitude of the forces that are sort of stacked up against us, right? I mean, we're against all the big carbohydrate industries, soy, wheat, grain, we're against big pharma, which they don't benefit if people get healthy and stop taking their medications. And there are various ideological movements that, you know, feel passionately that people should not eat animals, which is the major source of protein and fat. And also all the institutions and professors that have staked their professional and institutional reputations on being right. And they are defending themselves, and they are actively going after any challengers, I think, in a pretty aggressive way. But the reason that I'm not pessimistic so much anymore is that I really do see a number of data points for change. And maybe it's sort of pie in the sky, but I really see them. I think we're in the midst of a paradigm shift now. I think we're riding mm-hmm. the rocky waves of this paradigm shift right now. And this is why I think that. One is that even though it's sort of a rudimentary measure, if you look at Google searches on diet, the fastest increasing ones and also the ones with currently the largest volume are keto and low carb. Hmm. And what is declining the most is low fat. So there's a real interesting curiosity in this different kind of diet. Number two, you can see the expert community shifting. Like, it's not just this Lancet review on my book, and my book has also gotten good reviews in other really important journals, the British Medical Journal and the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. But not just me, but the Lancet also recently came out with, they published something called the PURE study, P-U-R-E, which is the largest ever, it's an epidemiological study, but still it came out with findings that were completely contrary to the dietary guidelines, which said that high carbohydrate diets were associated with early death, higher rates of heart disease, low carbohydrate diets were associated with longer life, and that a higher fat diet, including saturated fat, had better cardiovascular outcomes. And that study was roundly criticized, but the Lancet stood behind it. And the principal investigator of that study was the immediate past president of the World Heart Federation.
Wow.
So that's all, that's the central group for all the heart associations all over the world. And he has, his name is Salim Youssef, and he has really stood up and said quite strongly, the dietary guidelines are not based on good science. And there are a number of other expert journals that are saying the same thing in different ways. They're saying that the salt recommendations, the idea that lower is better for salt, is also not based on good science. You know, it turns out that for salt, a kind of medium level of consumption is the healthiest. And you see this more and more in papers that are being published by top journals, really challenging the status quo. So I think it is almost impossible that once you have the expert community is the one that has been sort of scared and almost like hiding in the alleyways and not invited to major conferences and afraid to talk about the results. But there's a growing sense that it's almost impossible to continue denying the effects of low carb. And, you know, here's another data point. The largest ever controlled clinical trial on diabetics with the low carb diet, 420 patients going on in the United States, had their 1 year results that are not yet published, but nearly 80% of them after 1 year on a low carb diet, a very low carb diet, had completely reversed their diagnosis of diabetes, which is to say they're no longer diabetic.
We're talking type 2.
Yeah, type 2 diabetes. Yeah, that's an important point. But I mean, this is, you know, so worldwide, there's an agreement that amongst experts that diabetes is a progressive, irreversible disease. And here you have a study coming out that will be just, it will be undeniable that that's not the case. So I really think that the combination of science, the number, there are now hundreds, thousands of doctors who are practicing low carb in different countries. I just think it's going to be impossible to keep all those voices down. You know, and once the genie's out of the bottle, it's out of the bottle.
Well, let's get into the nitty gritty for anybody this is their first podcast and they haven't heard this information before from us. So let's talk about really simply what fats to avoid and which ones to celebrate and put into our diet, as long as we don't have any, I guess, intolerances to any of these fats.
Right. So, you know, the conventional wisdom, what we've been told is to eat a low fat diet, which is to say between 30-35% of your calories is fat. Maybe at some point it was as low as 25%. And for all of those fat calories to come from plant-based sources, so vegetable oils. There's now consensus that your diet should be, I think even amongst most experts, that your diet should be a little bit higher in fat. And there's a belief that, you know, it's okay, you can have olive oil, you can have, but mainly to keep it to plant-based fats. The reality, as the science shows, is that actually you should be incorporating in your diet, the healthier fats really are saturated fats, which say those are the fats in meat. You should be having full fat dairy. You should not have low fat dairy. You should not have any low fat products, of course, because low fat products are almost inevitably higher in carbohydrates, often just higher in sugar, like low-fat yogurts, much higher in sugar, low-fat peanut butter, higher in sugar. And you should not have lean meat. Lean meat is not preferable to a fattier cut of meat. Red meat is fine. People have some misunderstanding that, you know, red meat is like clogged with saturated fats, which is, would be fine if it were true, but it isn't even true. I mean, like a porterhouse steak is a third of the fat in that porterhouse steak is the same fat that's in olive oil. So, I mean, all foods are a combination of saturated and unsaturated fats. So it's because we've demonized saturated fats and associate certain foods with them, we've sort of given birth to all these misunderstandings about these foods. But saturated fats, which we've long thought are just the worst possible thing to eat, let me tell you a couple surprises about them. Number one, they're the only food known to raise your HDL, which is your good cholesterol. So if you have low HDL and you go to your doctor and your doctor says you've got to get your HDL up, which is true because HDL is a pretty reliable predictor of heart disease risk, your doctor may tell you to exercise more or drink more red wine. Well, those may raise your HDL a little bit, but will most efficiently raise your HDL is to eat more saturated fat. Saturated fat is also really important for your respiratory health, sort of for all the linings of the sheaths in your lungs, all your lung cells. And it's important to your brain. And another unsung virtue of saturated fats is that they're stable when heated. This is a super important point. Vegetable oils, when you heat them, they're unstable, without getting into all the chemistry too much, but they degrade into toxic oxidation products. There's a whole section in this in my book where if you really want to freak out, you can read that section and learn about exploding uniforms in fast food restaurants because these workers have been working with heated toxic vegetable oils, which literally the uniforms like spontaneously combust because of the degraded oxidation products on those uniforms. That's what's happening in your body when you have stuff fried in vegetable oils or heated with vegetable oils. So you should never cook with vegetable oils. You should only cook with solid, stable fats. Those are saturated fats. So those are, now I'm going to say a really bad word, L-A-R-D, lard, the traditional cooking fat in Western culture before 1900, butter, tallow, coconut oil if you're not having animal fats. The one that's used in manufactured foods is palm oil. It's also saturated. Those are stable and they do not degrade it. They don't degrade when heated. So, a good diet should include those fats, should include butter, definitely butter, not margarine, and using solid fats for cooking, and then not to eat low fat foods really of any kind, because again, those are higher in carbohydrates. Does that cover all the fats?
I
think it does.
I actually cooked our dinner last night in duck fat, and geez, it tastes good.
Yeah.
And,
it does.
French didn't have it wrong, did they?
No. And McDonald's used to fry their French fries in tallow. And recently, a journalist did a taste test of where they went back and they had some French fries. Actually, at McDonald's, where they for old time's sake, they fried some French fries in tallow and then compared it to the taste of those, the way they fry them now in soybean oil. And, 100% of the people tested, which I think was just like a dozen people or so, but everybody preferred the French fries in tallow. So maybe one day we'll remember what chips were really supposed to taste like.
Let's just briefly, I know you've discussed it in our documentary, The Magic Pill, and you did it so well. But for anyone that hasn't seen the film, I'd love for you to talk about how the dietary guidelines actually got set up, because it was only 30, 40, 50 years ago that these guidelines appeared. Can you take us through the history of this, please?
Yeah, it really did start in America in the 1950s when the whole nation was in this panic over the rising tide of heart disease, which had been rare to non-existent in the early part of the century, but had risen to become the number one killer. And even President Eisenhower himself had a heart attack in 1955, was out of the Oval Office for 10 days. Imagine your president being out of the Oval, out of office for 10 days. So everybody was in a panic, like what caused heart disease? And there were a number of different theories about it. Some people thought vitamin deficiency, other people thought auto exhaust, more cars, other people thought type A personality. But there was one theory that was promoted by a pathologist at the University of Minnesota. His name was Ansel Benjamin Keys. And he said it was saturated fats and dietary cholesterol that caused heart disease. So you would eat saturated fat and cholesterol, mainly in animal foods. They would clog your arteries, and that would eventually give you a heart attack. And that was called the diet heart hypothesis. So it was just his idea. But as I describe in my book, he was this incredibly charismatic, sort of oversized, aggressive individual who managed to persuade his peers of this idea and get it implanted into the American Heart Association. At that point, there were no dietary guidelines. So really, the main trusted public institution looking at heart disease was the American Heart Association that had started back in 1948. And so in 1961, Ansel Keys is able to get himself on the nutrition committee of the American Heart Association and implant his idea into that group, such that the first recommendation anywhere in the world to avoid saturated fat and cholesterol, to avoid a heart attack, at that point just for men, was in 1961. It was the American Heart Association that launched that whole thing. It was really like the tiny acorn that became the giant oak tree of advice we have today. And the American Heart Association really drove this whole process. You know, when eventually the U.S. government got into the act, they had a series of hearings. The Senate had a series of hearings on diet. The American Heart Association experts dominated those hearings. A report was drafted by a staffer who turned out was a vegetarian. Everybody was anti-meat. Everything was informed by American Heart Association experts. And so we launched our dietary guidelines in 1980 with this same platform that we have today, but, you know, saying high-carb diet, mainly grain-based. Now we call it plant-based, but it's the same thing. Low in animal foods. And that was the beginning of it all. And then we exported it to the rest of the world. And that was the first year that really obesity, which had been lurking but not a huge problem, that was the beginning of the obesity epidemic in America.
Scary stuff indeed. So I guess for anyone that's listening out there that is going to their doctor, they've got high cholesterol, they're putting them on statins. Do you have any advice or any, if they say you must be having this at this point in time, is there a solution to this? Because I've seen in a lot of cases that, or a lot of research, that statins aren't the be-all and end-all for cholesterol treatment.
You know, the statins debate is a whole other field that I haven't studied in tremendous depth, but I do know that, you know, the clinical trials we base our recommendations on are all funded by the drug companies, that there's no access to the original data for it to be re-examined by outside authorities. There have been major fights to try to get that data, but they won't release it. And statins really depend on this idea that lowering your LDL cholesterol is the key to reducing your heart disease risk. So what I'd like to say is this. There has never been a clinical trial in which lowering your LDL cholesterol by diet has improved your cardiovascular risk. So whether or not statins work, which is a whole minefield I don't feel like touching right now, lowering your LDL cholesterol by diet has never been shown to be effective. And kind of the short explanation is it's more complicated than just LDL cholesterol. It turns out that really, you know, of the things you regularly measure, your HDL cholesterol over your triglycerides is a more reliable indicator of your cardiovascular risk. LDL cholesterol turns out to be more complicated. There's a dense kind and kind of a light, fluffy kind. And if you have the dense kind, that is much more predictive of your cardiovascular risk. So the whole cholesterol story turns out to be much more complicated. And it's a minefield because the pharmaceutical industry is so invested in this idea that it all comes down to your LDL cholesterol because that's what they know how to reduce with statins. They haven't produced a drug that can reduce your triglycerides or raise your HDL cholesterol. So they have a drug that reduces LDL cholesterol. So that's why they promote that heart attack risk factor. You know, cardiologists are, if you look at who funds their association and what they're driven by the pharmaceutical companies. So it's a very fraught field. There's you know, we are all over medicated societies. We're just given pills. And as your movie, The Magic Pill, its thesis is, you know, what is the magic pill? It doesn't come out of a bottle. It comes out of a diet. You can cure yourself with diet.
I can see a new book in the making for you anyway, or many, many books in the making for you. And I guess our listeners and myself especially would love to know what your ingredients for a beautiful recipe for life is. And it doesn't have to be food-based, but if you could share a couple of insights into what keeps Nina healthy, happy, fully present in this crazy world that sometimes we live in.
You know, I'm always embarrassed by this question because I don't really have a particularly healthy lifestyle. You know, I work too hard. I don't get enough sleep. I don't do anything right, really, because, you know, I have kind of been bitten by this passion to try to get as much done as I possibly can on this issue. And I just feel so strongly about it. But that said, I think a passion for your work is, I feel enormously grateful to have it. If you can find that in life, and I spent many years wandering in the wilderness without it, you know, so I know the other side. I think it's a very lucky thing to have, to enjoy your work. And I certainly enjoy mine. And other than that, I just got a dog for the first time in my life. And I have to say that that is a total joy. And, you know, nature, having people to love, and in those moments when you aren't working, to really be with people that you really care about and feel grateful for what you're doing. To me, that's a pretty basic formula, but I think that is still a tried and true one for me, at least.
Nina, I would like to just tell you that we all love you, and we thank you for sharing your time and your wisdom today. And hopefully you can find a little bit more time for yourself. But otherwise, we look forward to your new book, and also for the changes that you're going to make to the dietary guidelines in America, which will have a flow-on effect for the rest of the world. If there's one person that can actually change the guidelines, it's going to be you. So we'll give you all the support that you need.
Thanks for your optimism. And I just want to say thank you for all you're doing, and thank you for having me on your show. And it's just such a pleasure to talk to you. So thank you.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.